Accession number 9794, Real 2.
Well, it's Real 2.
Hopefully my bomb aimer, who after all had received some navigational training, would be able to get some good landfalls, either, albeit at night, on crossing the coast and rivers and such like, to call back to me. I would be plotting these positions on my map. And really, the journey into the target from wherever one crossed the coast was very much of a nothing for a navigator, except he would hear occasional chit-chat over the intercom between members of the crew. But I do remember, because it was the first time I had been to a target, that when we got into the Ruhr area, I was allowed up from my dungeon or cell down below, and I remember standing very well behind Sergeant Kidd as we approached the target. And of course, the Ruhr of all targets, I always thought was the most awe-inspiring, because if you happen to be bombing somewhere like Essen, which really was in the centre of the Ruhr area, a very heavily defended area, one had probably something like, I don't know, 10 minutes, a quarter of an hour, maybe 20 minutes of flying through fairly rough, a fairly rough area, in as much as flak was bursting all over the place, not necessarily being fired at us, but it was bursting all over the place. There were certainly hundreds of searchlights in the sky. One could see other aircraft coned in searchlights and being shot at. One could see aircraft going down in flames. And it was all in all, I would almost say, a frightening experience, really. Certainly exciting as a first entry into battle, really. And one was very grateful to get home, really, from that. And one was also, I mean, this was the whole thing, crews were very, very raw. They hardly knew each other. You know, we'd become reasonable friends, but how you behave in those conditions were, one never knew, and one didn't know how a pilot would react, really.
How might he react?
How are you asking that question?
Yes.
Yes, I would think that Sergeant Kidd, Bob Kidd, who was our pilot, New Zealander, his reaction really was probably rather violent, really, in as much as I don't mean aggressively violent, but he certainly tried to throw the aircraft around all over the place. Maybe, I mean, as events prove later on in the war, and this, I must say, must have been due to his inexperience, and we all know now, with hindsight, that it was the inexperienced crews that were certainly the ones that were going to suffer the greatest when it came to casualties. And I certainly think that that he as a pilot probably all, well, and indeed all of us were sufficiently inexperienced. We were fair game. Fortunately, we survived. But I must make this point, and what I can't remember is the exact number of crews on the number 26 OTU course that I was on. They were mainly Australian pilots. I guess there were probably 10, maybe a dozen crews that carried out those operations. There was one other operation to Bremen for which we weren't briefed. These three operations, Dusseldorf, Essen and Bremen, took place, I would think, in the matter of a week. We were briefed for two of them. But out of those 12 crews, as far as I recall, there were only two crews that left OTU. The others all were missing from those operations for whatever reason. Whether they were killed or became prisoners of war, I don't know. I know some were killed.
What was the nature of the targets on these particular raids?
By nature, what do you mean?
Or were you bombing factories or residential areas or what? Did you have a specific target that you had to go for?
Essen and Düsseldorf, I would say we were certainly bombing the centre of the towns in each case. In each case. I can't honestly remember at that stage whether we were bombing factory areas or maybe dock areas on the Rhine. I can't honestly remember that. At a later stage, I can recall certain things in briefings, but for those two operations, I can't really remember. Certainly at Bremen, I'm fairly certain that although we weren't briefed, they must have been briefed to bomb the docks there, because that was the pattern at the time, as we subsequently discovered.
Well, what type of accuracy do you think was achieved at that time, in 1942?
Poor, I would say, as a whole. Spasmodic, I would think poor accuracy.
Can you describe what the impact of the bombs looked like at night?
My bomb aimer, Sergeant Bell, is always of the opinion that we were a long way from the target when we undershot the target by some distance, he feels, on that particular Essen raid. That he thinks that we dropped our bombs before we actually got, although we were certainly in the midst of a heavily defended area, he felt that we never actually got to the target area. Although it was very difficult to very difficult in those conditions to even identify the target, because the Ruhr at that time was a highly activated part of the air, very much so. Sorry, you asked me a question.
The impact of the bombs, what did that look like from where you were?
Certain amount of fires. I mean, one could never see one's own bombs land. I mean, there were flashes going on all the time. I don't know how many aircraft took part in the raid on Essen, but I would think certainly 600 upwards. And there were flashes on the ground all the time of explosions of bombs, but one could see fires and that sort of thing, but fairly widespread, I would think.
You've talked in the Blitz about the Germans dropping landmines.
Yes.
Did you ever drop anything of that kind yourself?
No. 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 Not at any time. I think I'm pretty certain that I did a tour with in Bomber Command, but I think the heaviest bomb that we ever dropped was a 2,000-pounder. High explosive. Most of the things that we carried were incendiaries, in fact. But on the trip to Essen, they were 400-500-pound bombs.
Now, can we pick up the narrative from where I interrupted you?
Do you want me to go on from the OTU
yes,
now?
Please.
Right, well, after the Essen raid, that was our last flight from OTU. We left OTU with a posting to number 149 Conversion Squadron at, I think that was in Mildenhall. And 149 Squadron was equipped with Stirling aircraft. which was a much larger. It was a four-engined aircraft. It required a crew of seven. Remember that we, in flying in Wellingtons, had been a crew of five. It needed certainly a different technique as far as the pilot was concerned, because of the size of the aircraft, the fact that there were four engines. He had to learn quite a bit about flying Stirlings. There were some more sophisticated navigational aids on a Stirling, in as much as navigator was going to learn something about what I shall describe just now as a G-box. And so it was necessary to be converted onto Stirlings. We went to 149 conversion squadron, but almost immediately, and I think at this stage what must have been happening was that instead of squadrons converting crews on the squadron, conversion units were formed. In other words, there were stations devoted entirely just to converting aircraft on crews onto Stirlings. And so even after a few days, I would think, we left 149 conversion squadron and we went to Stradishall, Royal Air Force Stradishall in Suffolk, to number 1657 conversion squadron. And here the practice was, because the pilot had quite a lot to learn, the navigator not very much. The use of the G-box could be gained fairly quickly. The pilot needed to do quite a lot of flying. And in fact, what happened was that as a crew arrived at the conversion unit, they had to pick up two new members of crew, in as much as there was a flight engineer and a mid-upper gunner. And what happened was that the pilot that one had at the operational training unit, in our case Sergeant Kidd, he started an intensive course of flying on Stirlings, and we, the rest of the crew, in fact, picked up a pilot who had already gone through that course. So, in fact, we said goodbye to Sergeant Kidd, and became the crew of Flying Officer Cook, who had, by that time, already completed a tour of operations on Whitley aircraft. In other words, he'd flown 30 operations already. He knew what it was all about. He had been instructing at an operational training unit for a while after his first tour. And I suppose we were very fortunate indeed to have come across a pilot with experience, and I suppose it was his inevitable bad luck that he would pick up a raw crew. But that is what happened. Cookie, as I should call him, had by that stage already been awarded the Distinguished Flying Medal. And we spent rather looks like 2 or 3 weeks flying with Flying Officer Cook in Stirlings, doing various exercises. In other words, we were getting accustomed to flying in a large aircraft. I was using a G-box, and do you want me to say anything about the G-box?
Well, perhaps you could say what it was like from your point of view working it, how you found it to work.
G-Box was a navigational aid, the only really accurate instrument that could, in within a limited range, but a very useful range, give very precise information on your air ground position at any time, and it was very exact and a great boon to navigators.
Was it easy to work from your
point? Very simple to work. Very simple to work. It really was a series of positions indicated on a something like a cathode ray tube, rather like a television screen, which were then transformed into predetermined position lines on a navigational map. It was quite easy to operate. Didn't require, I would say, any skill at all, really. And it was a boon to the navigation of aircraft. So at the end of that period of instruction, we found ourselves posted to number 15 squadron in three group bomber command, a Stirling squadron based at Bourne.
And where's Bourne?
Bourne is located on the Cambridge St. Neots Road, about 7 or 8 miles west of Cambridge. Our pilot was an officer, the rest of the crew were sergeants. Sergeant Collins, the flight engineer, again, we were extremely lucky in as much as Sergeant Collins had been a boy apprentice in the Royal Air Force, trained at Halton in the years before the war. He knew a lot about what made aircraft fly, and he also had flown a tour on Stirlings as a flight engineer. So when we went to 15 Squadron, we had a pilot and a flight engineer, both of whom had independently completed 30 operations with Bomber Command. So we weren't 100% inexperienced crew. The rest of us were rookies. We went to 15 Squadron under the command of Wing Commander Paddy Menall, who only died last week. I noticed, I read his obituary there, Vice Marshal. I don't know whether you read that.
Yes, I did.
But he was our squadron commander then. And we were at 15 Squadron for a limited period. I will come to that. But we flew 5 operations from 15 Squadron in Stirlings. 5 completed operations. The first 2 were quite long ones for an inexperienced navigator. They were both of 8.5 hours duration. One was to Turin, where we brought back a photograph plotted 3/4 of a mile from the aiming point, which in those days was considered excellent, I think. Went to Stuttgart. We had 2 abortive trips where we were briefed to Stettin. These were all in November 1942, to Stettin on the Baltic coast, when we got a recall for some reason. We, again, on the 28th of November, were briefed for Turin, and my note in the logbook says we got as far as the wash, where our starboard outer engine packed up. We dropped our bombs in the wash and returned to base. Early in December, we raided Frankfurt, in mid-December, we attacked an airfield of all places called Dieppolz. I could never quite understand why we were briefed for that. And there was a long period then, I suppose due to weather, of about a month before we went to a place called Lorient in Brittany, where we actually got a photograph of the aiming point. I've lumped those together, and I must say that the first two long trips, Turin and Stuttgart, 8 hours duration, were a bit of a nightmare for me as a navigator, because it is a long way to be away from home. But nevertheless, we got back, and gradually, and I believe that the trip to Frankfurt and Dieppolz transformed the crew. We suddenly became, and I still remember now, the makings of a worthwhile and good crew. Things, we were working together, the navigation was becoming simpler, we were arriving at our points, and one had a certain amount of confidence that at least if we were going to land up into trouble, it wasn't going to be due to bad flying or bad navigation. It was going to be due to some action on the enemy's part, because I do believe that many of the losses to Bomber Command weren't always due to enemy action. Some were just due to poor airmanship due to inexperience. At the end of 1942, mid-January 1943, because my pilot, who at that time had been promoted to a flight lieutenant, he then, I suppose because of his experience, was able to fill a flight commander's position at number 214 Squadron, which was based at Chedbur. He was promoted to squadron leader at that stage. And I see that by that time he had been awarded the Air Force Cross. And we went across to 214 Squadron with him. And we flew a number of operations with him from 214 Squadron. We did Lorient, Cologne, Wilhelmshaven, Nuremberg, a couple of trips to Berlin, Nuremberg again, mine laying, Saint-Nazaire. A fair concentration of operations during February and March of 1943.
Would you, how much fighter opposition would you have on these operations?
Well, when you say opposition, one was always in knowledge of fighter operation being there, because one was continually hearing reports from the mid-upper gunners and the rear gunners of attacks on other aircraft. I mean, they could see the tracer being fired from aircraft to aircraft. As far as we were concerned, I think that it's fair to say that during the period we were flying with Squadron Leader Cook, we probably only were attacked on two occasions by fighters. And when I use the word attacked, I will say that we had a passing volley of shots which didn't hit us, but one, they were seen, and Cookie was a very, very skillful pilot. I can't praise him sufficiently highly. Extremely capable pilot. The way he could manoeuvre a Stirling aircraft was, I think, exceptional. And having had an attack at all by a pilot, they were never in a position to resume the attack, because I suppose a combination of the his own evasive action and the cover of darkness enabled us to get away. But there was certainly was plenty of night fighter activity to and from the targets.
Would the Germans send fighters up when their anti-aircraft guns were operating, or would it be one or the other?
You're probably talking about the target area, really.
Yes.
It would be one or the other.
So if you are having flak...
If I could put it this way, you see, what would often happen, and because I never know how it was controlled, but one, for instance, would be flying into a target area, or even if one was, say, flying the Kiel Canal, which was a corridor between Denmark and Germany, which was very heavily defended. It was a route into Germany, sometimes used. One could be flying in that area, and there would obviously be searchlights and very heavy concentration of guns. Now, if an aircraft, and one could see this happening, if an aircraft was picked up by what was known as a master searchlight, this was a searchlight which had a rather bluey tinge. It must have had some very good control, because often its finger would shoot up and locate an aircraft first time, straight onto an aircraft. Having done that, a host of other backup searchlights would concentrate. You'd have an aircraft coned in that area. Now, at that stage, anything could happen. Well, any of two things could happen. You would either get concentrated flak at the apex. Probably it would result eventually in the aircraft being shot down. Or the aircraft may, by dint of good flying skill, get out of the cone of searchlights. But of course, an aircraft traversing the sky at somewhere like 3 miles or above moves across the sky very, very slowly, and it's not difficult for searchlights to drift along with the aircraft. So they would be concentrated with flak. If one didn't see a concentration of flak at that point, one knew jolly well that some fighters were going to come in and pick it off. And that's really what happened, because if you're coned in searchlights and you're not being shot at, you know damn well that somewhere there's a fighter lurking. How the control was done from the ground, I don't know. But so in answer to your question, there were always fighters and flak in the area. But usually I would think fighters were more in evidence on the way in and out of a target rather than over the aiming point itself.
Were you ever coned?